Good afternoon and welcome to Keep Calm and Carry On Investing. I'm your host, Daniel Paris. This is a special two-part episode. It's called Fallacy or Philosophy, Academic Finance's Big 60-Year Debate. In this episode, I'm taking up an old academic tussle, but one that I think is important for business investors trying to figure out the stock market. The material for this podcast is really designed as a book chapter, and so the podcast version is necessarily both abbreviated and without all the footnotes. The full text, with all the gory details, is available on my website on the same page as the podcast link. So let's get started. It is an article of faith in academic finance that the proper value of a project or an investment is associated with the net present value of the discounted future cash flows of said project or investment. This approach graces most written valuation work, from a passing reference early in academic finance articles to the obligatory cash flow model at the end of stock analyst reports. It's reflected in the argot of the trade, DDM, IRR, DCF, NPV, etc. Paths diverge as to the best form of manifestation. Is it just cash flows through equity? Is it distributed cash payments to the equity holders? Is it levered or unlevered? The terminal value approaches, etc., and there is a vast array of calculation options. Although this framework has been largely ignored the past few decades in the stock market's anything-goes environment, it still constitutes the agreed-upon general philosophical framework for equity valuation. This consensus on valuing companies based on cash flows creates a striking paradox. For the past 60-some years, the leading lights of academic finance have been nearly equally united in its explicit rejection of the most straightforward default manifestation of a discounted cash flow approach for minority shareholders of publicly traded equities, that is, the lowly dividend, the income stream reserved for the none-too-bright retail investors, for widows and orphans and other lesser souls. I'm not suggesting that the entire academic finance community shares this view, but as far as academic views that make it from gown to town and that are broadly disseminated and recognized in the practitioner community, yes, it is nearly united in its dismissal of dividend investing. The purpose of this narrative today is to point out this divergence, suggest why it has occurred, and how it can be resolved. It is indeed a puzzle, as one of the prominent anti-dividend commentators called it in 1976. But the puzzle is not why dividends are paid and sought after, as he questioned, but why anyone would think otherwise. As is often the case in my analysis, the answer is substantially historical. That is, it is all too common in finance and investing to assume that the rules are the rules and have always been that way and will always be that way. Memorize the rules and make a lot of money. Rinse and repeat, so goes the formula. Well, it turns out that that is not correct. Many of the so-called rules by which we live, invest, or have a specific context of creation that explains them. They were relevant in that context. They may or may not be relevant in a different context. Or as John Maynard Keynes supposedly, but apparently never said, when the facts change, I alter my conclusions, what do you do? In a book published several years ago, I took the same approach to modern portfolio theory, pointed out its historical context, averred that the facts had changed, and encouraged investors to consider whether it was time for a new approach to portfolio construction. The academic disdain for dividend investing falls into the same category. It has a history. I will share that history. You can judge whether or not it is still relevant. So let us start with that history, actually the positive part of the story, before a prominent and highly visible part of the community, academic community, turned on it. Before that point, building valuation exercises around discounted cash flows and, by extension, dividend payments from publicly traded companies to minority shareholders was established as a narrated, explicit cornerstone of valuation work by figures such as Irving Fisher in 1906, John Burr Williams in 1938, and more practically by the better-known Benjamin Graham, among others, in the first half of the 20th century, Ben Graham writing most famously in the 1930s and 40s. From that perspective, dividend payments were understood to be consistent with the broader idea of business ownership. An investor purchases a minority stake in a business and receives a proportional share of the profits in return. It's not all that complicated, folks. And to a great extent, the work done by the individuals referenced above was just codifying millennia of actual business and investment practice where a stream of future payments would be equated in some fashion or another to the market value of an asset. Just think of any reasonably thought through, unforced purchase of productive agricultural land at any time in recorded history, or British crown loans used to fight endless wars with France starting in the late 17th century. The exercise becomes more developed over the centuries until it is formally articulated in the early 20th century. While the term dividend has rightly and accurately passed into general usage with a positive connotation, an activity that pays a dividend, the term return has evolved over time. It started out signifying the physical return of cash at the end of an investment, the physical return of the initial investment amount with some extra to represent the profit. That was the nature of the earliest joint stock companies associated with specific ventures. It was essentially a liquidating payment of the enterprise. Over time, the term return came to represent the cash payment of profits in cash from an ongoing enterprise. Or if from a private asset, the returns were the rents from real estate or the yields of the productive land. Yes, the price of an asset rose and fell every day on London's Exchange Alley, New York's Wall Street, and anywhere else investments were sold, but non-speculative thinking about such investments, to the extent that there was some thinking, came from contemplating the income stream associated with the asset. The math of total return incorporating both price change and income generation became more formalized in the post-World War II period as data sets, indices, and total return calculation mechanisms appeared. Starting in the 1950s, modern portfolio theory, MPT, emerged as an approach that, while necessarily including the dividend in the total return equation, began focusing more attention on the ever-changing array of daily asset prices and their relationship to one another. As I've argued elsewhere, MPT is a theory of prices for people focusing on data sets of prices, not a theory of business ownership through the stock market. That is, over the past 70 years, the term return has evolved to represent a mostly non-cash return, the opposite of how it started. It's now basically just the change in the publicly quoted price of a venture. There's nothing per se wrong with that, but it's important to point out the history of these concepts. This sustained shift in perspective from ownership of an income-producing asset to asset price maximization, with little attention paid to the income stream, creates the foundation for the paradox that is the topic of today's podcast. The intellectual history of this movement away from dividends is well known. It is, in fact, so well known that I believe many investors simply cite the founding document from 1961, 60 years ago, but don't actually read it or haven't read it in years. That document is worth reviewing closely. A small portion of it remains relevant. The rest of it is so woefully out of date as to now perhaps meet the standard of simply being wrong. The authors, both long deceased, received Nobel Prizes for their efforts and have privileged positions in the pantheon of academic finance. Merely suggesting that this particular work might no longer be relevant invites ridicule from the academy. I'm expecting that. But as Keynes famously warned at the end of The General Theory in 1936, quote, "The ideas of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influences are usually the slaves of some defunct economist," end quote. Well, Franco Modigliani and Merton Miller, popularly known as M&M, made what now seems like a common sense argument in 1958 that the value of a firm should be based on its assets and earnings potential, not how the entity is financed or the precise nature of its capital structure, that is, the amount of debt and equity. It was a whiteboard argument, but it put forth the important conceptual framework that the capital structure of a firm should, all other things, including taxes, being kept equal, be irrelevant to the market value of a business. 3 years later, in the Journal of Finance, M&M extended their argument from the front end of the horse, the company's capital structure, to the business end, the company's distributions and returns. Consistent with the increasing focus on share prices, they asked, quote, is there an optimum dividend payout ratio or range of ratios that maximizes the current worth of the shares, end quote. That is, does a higher payout ratio lead to higher share prices? The subsequent argument is redolent with the rational actor and perfect markets theories popular at the time, but the key assertion is that, quote, for the higher the dividend payout in any period, the more the new capital must be raised from external sources to maintain any desired level of investment, end quote. That's from page 413 of the article, for those of you keeping score. M&M therefore concluded that a company's dividend policy is irrelevant because higher payouts necessarily lead to dilutive capital raising for a given level of capital expenditure by the company. Lower payouts lead to less dilutive capital raising for the same level of investment. The two different approaches to the challenge of growth result in the same outcome at the individual share level. Hence, a company's dividend payout policy should be irrelevant to the price of a share. Their conclusion creates a rather elegant symmetry of irrelevance involving the capital structure going in and the distributions coming out. Did you catch the mistake? It's hiding there in plain sight. Hint, in 1961, it probably wasn't a mistake, but it's a huge one today, and one that more or less reverses the author's conclusions for today's corporate managers and investors. The key phrase is, quote, for a given level of investment, end quote. And you will note the critical assumption that the given level of investment involved is invariably greater than cash flow from operations minus the dividend, and thus requires external capital. More if the payout ratio is higher, less if the payout ratio is lower. That's the rub. I don't have detailed access to the net income, depreciation, and capital expenditure numbers, the constituents for the simplest definition of free cash flow for the market in the early 1960s, but it is a reasonable assumption that during the heyday for the industrial manufacturing economy, the country's leading companies had substantial growth opportunities to pursue, and that they were capital intensive. All that plant, property, and equipment came at a cash cost. So capital intensive industries in growth mode in 1961 would have been cash flow negative and would have needed to raise external capital to fund all of their investment plans and pay their dividend. In that case, M&M made sense. Well done. Updating M&M for the age of the share buyback, our current age, is not difficult. Companies repurchasing their own shares was not a prominent feature of the stock market at the time, but since the 1990s, buybacks have come to dominate the stock market demand landscape and have regularly exceeded the S&P 500 index aggregate dollar amount of dividends for the past two decades. When the buybacks are financed from debt, the original 1958 M&M propositions would apply, as it just represents a recapitalizing of a company with a different mix of debt and equity. This modern application of M&M requires, naturally, perfect markets, none of the inconveniences of tax differentials, good timing of buybacks, and that the buybacks actually reduce share count. That actually happens a lot less than you would think, but we'll take it as a given for the sake of argument. Fast forward 60 years, however, and M&M's base case is no longer remotely the norm, except for a small subset of the market. Utilities now represent just 3.2% of the S&P 500 index. That's as of the autumn of 2020. They do regularly run free cash flow negative and have to raise external capital to fund the substantial investments needed to modernize our power grids. Many real estate investment trusts fall into the same category. They represent another 2.6% of the S&P 500 index. In theory, and holding all other factors equal, M&M still applies to them. It might also pertain to certain capital-intensive companies with dividend payments structurally and regularly in excess of their cash flows from operations minus capital expenditures. So how much of the market does the M&M dividend irrelevancy proposition apply to now? On an ongoing basis, is it 5%? Is it 10% of the S&P 500 index? Can't be much more. We're now a service economy, and one in which the overwhelming majority of S&P 500 index companies can fund their growth plans without raising external capital. They thereby fall outside the M&M dividend relevancy framework. At the aggregate level, the S&P 500 index has been in that state since 1993, with brief and shallow exceptions during the contractions of 2001, 2009, and very likely 2020. In their original argument, M&M acknowledged a scenario in which they would be wrong. They admitted that for internally financed companies, which they call an extreme or special case, that, quote, dividend policy is indistinguishable from investment policy, and there is an optimal investment policy, which does, in general, depend on the rate of return, end quote. M&M do not like the analytical implications of this scenario at all. They go so far as to call it treacherous. So what was once dismissed with some degree of contempt, frankly, is now the norm. This scenario can also, this internally financed scenario, can also be modernized for the age of buybacks. If the share repurchases are financed from retained earnings, then we have the same flaw that the original 1961 M&M propositions have. The dividend and/or buyback policy counts as an alternative to an investment decision. It may be good, it may be bad, it may be neutral, but it cannot be irrelevant. Now, it is critically important to step back from the details and acknowledge the difference between what M&M wrote nearly 60 years ago, and how their article is being used by market participants more than a half century later. For sure, the article is not read. Let me repeat that. Outside of the academy, I'm willing to bet that no more than 5% of market participants or investment practitioners who reference M&M or dividend irrelevancy have actually read the article, or more importantly, considered its implication in the economy and market as it is now, not in 1961. Instead, M&M is just a code word for the general dismissal of dividend payments by corporations, often in favor of share buybacks, and the general dismissal of cash-paying business ownership by stock investors in favor of finding the next dividend-free NASDAQ darling. That is, it's not what M&M said. It's what people now think they said. There's a big difference. That might not have been the case, but for their coining of an admittedly catchy phrase, dividend irrelevancy, which goes well beyond M&M's core and quite legitimate point about external financing and dilution. Without that moniker, I suspect that few market participants would recognize the original M&M dividend propositions at all. Words matter. Semantics matter. How many extra tractor sales has the company with the phrase, nothing runs like a deer, enjoyed over the years? Coke adds life. It's the real thing. Nike's just do it. You get my point, it applies even in academia. The dividend irrelevancy theorem is well named, and perhaps for that reason it has enjoyed a longer and broader life than it should have. Don't get me wrong, M&M 1961 is not technically wrong, especially in the very narrow way it is defined, but it is substantially, misleadingly out of date. That is not the main flaw, however. The real issue is never raised in the article, or much of the academic narrative against dividend payments that I will review here. The real flaw is equating capital gains to a dividend payment. Mathematically, they are identical. That's the view from academic finance. A number is a number is a number. Money is fungible, particularly in academic exercises involving what they call perfect markets. In M&M 1961, the authors treat the matter casually. Quote, investors always prefer more wealth to less, okay, and are indifferent as to whether the given increment to their wealth takes the form of cash payments or an increase in the market value of their holdings of shares, end quote. Almost all subsequent writing on the topic agrees with that assertion, either explicitly or implicitly, by trying to prove which approach, capital gains or dividends, leads to a greater total return. From a business ownership perspective, however, they are not the same, not even close, not even remotely in the same league. And the logic of business ownership, particularly for minority shareholders of publicly traded companies, makes a cash distribution from profits, not going into the marketplace to harvest potential capital gains by selling shares, but by that cash distribution of profits, the natural mechanism of sharing in the success of an enterprise, whether public or private. Let that be considered a maxim of business ownership. It is a matter of philosophy, not mathematical formulas. Beyond the philosophical differences, there are plenty of real-world ones, such as trading costs, market conditions, and differential tax rates that may make a dividend or a harvested capital gain more or less preferable than the other for individual and institutional investors. Whether in theory or in practice, these two activities, on one hand clipping your coupons, on the other going out and selling appreciated securities are most certainly not the same thing. This philosophical difference came to light 15 years after MNN when, in 1976, MIT professor Fisher Black pondered the existence of dividends at all. In a brief essay in the Journal of Portfolio Management, Black admitted not being able to figure out why companies paid dividends or investors sought them out at all. It was for him a puzzle, quote, a puzzle with pieces that just don't fit together, end quote. After rehashing the basic M&M propositions, Fisher listed ways for companies to return cash to shareholders other than dividends. The most obvious was share buybacks, which were still not as fashionable as they would become. His main argument, however, is taxes. At that time, they were higher on dividends than on capital gains, and one could be timed, the other could not. And from a corporate tax perspective, dividend payments were not deductible, and they still aren't, unlike interest payments on bonds. As a result, dividends are subject to double taxation, first at the corporate level and then at the investor level. Fisher Black sums up the problem, quote, with taxes, investors and corporations are no longer indifferent to the level of dividends. They prefer smaller dividends or no dividends at all, end quote. Black finds pro-dividend arguments about transaction costs for harvesting capital gains to be unconvincing. He similarly dismisses the idea that dividends are useful as a management signaling tool. He explores other reasons, potential reasons for dividend payments, such as trustee bias, pressure from retail investors, etc. None persuade him. Like M&M, Black acknowledges that companies with investment programs less than their free cash flow, he uses different words, might have a reason to pay a dividend. And like M&M 15 years earlier, Black considers this scenario a special case that is relatively rare. Let me repeat, it is now the clear and overwhelming majority case. 14 years later, in 1990, Black, then at Goldman Sachs, reiterated his view in a brief statement in the Financial Analyst Journal. With a flourish, he ended by forecasting that, quote, taxable dividends will gradually vanish, end quote. Nota bene here, 30 years after that statement, 45 years after his original statement, and 60 years after M&M, investors and companies continue to defy the academics. And yet the hostility remains throughout academia. In preparing for this podcast, I came upon perhaps the most concise summary of the academic argument against dividends. It's a beaut. Quote, the economic consequence of dividends is an involuntary tax liability to the owners of the firm imposed on a marginal liquidation of their ownership, end quote. That is, a dividend represents, at best, as it were, an unnecessary tax bill and a smaller stake in the company resulting from the company forced to hand out cash. Boy, it's hard to come up with a more damning description of the notion of business ownership. It goes beyond just the genuine problem of taxation to one of actual business ownership, that by receiving one's share of the profits, not leaving them in the corporation, one is participating in the forced diminution of the enterprise. Wow. The academic narrative against dividends has evolved over the years. In recent decades, the initial orthodox finance approach, of which there are hundreds of examples in the literature, folks feel free to scour JSTOR, SSRN, you will find references to and actual articles, hundreds if not thousands of articles in the tradition of M&M, in the tradition of Fisher Black. But for many of them, the tax differential looms large up through the 1980s. And that, in recent decades, has given way to a behavioral finance framework. In addition to generating tremendous insights, genuine insights into human behavior, the behavioral finance has yielded a lot of new material on why investors might seek dividends and the problems associated with that pursuit. But in many ways, the behavioral finance take on dividend investing is just the other side of the coin of the prior approach. Rather than assuming that investors are consistently rational and all-knowing, the behavioralists highlight the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to when it comes to investing. For a full list of those shocks, see the works of Kahneman and Tversky, Richard Thaler, Meyer Statman, among many others. Instead of being perfect at decision-making, it turns out that we're often quite biased, which makes us rather bad at it. While in the orthodox approach, dividend investing is simply a mistake by investors who should focus on less tax capital gains, in the behavioral version, it's more mental. It's a fallacy, a deficiency that is typical of investors who have biases, are not all-knowing, and make a myriad of little mistakes. They are not the rational machines from the prior model. Search again in SSRN or JSTOR, and you will find a lot of academics mulling over the, quote, dividend puzzle from a behavioral finance perspective. The behavioral finance literature on dividends is now itself more than 30 years old, but it has recently been well summarized and updated by two up-and-coming scholars, Samuel Hartzmark and David Solomon. Their Dividend Disconnect was just published in the very prestigious Journal of Finance last year. And I had the pleasure of having Solomon on the podcast earlier this year. He provided a great summary of their work in behavioral finance. In this particular article, they start with the obligatory reference to M&M and the philosophical assertion that a dividend is no different than a capital gain. From that premise, they pursue what they call the disconnect between how investors treat the income stream of an asset with the price of that asset. Having separate mental accounts, investors supposedly believe that their dividends are free, and they are supposedly unaware that dividends are coming out of the asset price. Since so much of the investment world is now measured and operates according to price change, not total return, the negative impact that dividend payments have on price returns necessarily leads to all sorts of investing and consumption distortions. They document those distortions in great detail. I'm not in a position to judge their empirical work, though I think they're on the wrong foot in regard to a particular assertion about dividend reinvestment. And that's a place where the difference between practitioner and academic is clear in this instance. But in general, one needs to assume that Hartzmark and Solomon have gotten their details and their math correct. And as such, they conclude that investors are, quote, more naive in regard to dividends than academic finance has generally assumed, end quote. Of course, I beg to differ here, and I will take up that disagreement in a moment. But both academic paradigms over a 60-year period look unkindly on investing for dividends. Try as they might, the community of the most visible and audible finance professors cannot find a logic to the most natural and logical form of rewarding minority stake business ownership. And that is a puzzle I hope to shed some light on. My answer here is twofold. First, I want to provide, as is my custom, some historical context to the dismissal of investing for dividends. Second, I want to point out that there is a serious business literature that dividend investors can look to. It's out there. It just doesn't have the same visibility in the practitioner community that it ought to. Perhaps this podcast will even the scales, if only a bit. As for the first point, the historical context, let's look at the so-called dividend disconnect. The first generation of antipathy to dividends, M&M, Black, and their numerous heirs from the 1950s through the mid-1980s, corresponds neatly to a period of materially higher taxes on dividends than on capital gains. Combined with an insistence on rational actors and that growing focus in academic finance on the world of share prices and their relationship to one another, well, the result was a glaring headwind to being a long-term business owner collecting one's coupons, at least from the perspective of the academy. Nevertheless, despite those taunts from the university parapets to investors to shift to capital gains and for companies to stop paying dividends entirely, profitable made distributions and company owners collected them throughout the entire period, even with marginal tax rates that at the time were eye-popping by today's standards. By the mid-1980s, the tax differential had declined substantially as qualified dividend tax rates declined and approached the level of capital gains taxes. The differential between the two has remained relatively low ever since, and for many investors, dividends and capital gains are now taxed at the same level. So other than the issue of timing, which for many investors is an important factor, taxes are no longer a major point of differentiation. But by the time the tax differential had faded, two other issues loomed large. The first was the rise of stock buybacks. Effectively made legal or feasible on a broad scale by a securities law change in 1982, they became increasingly popular in the following decade, and the annual dollar value of buybacks surpassed that of dividends in the U.S. market by the early 1990s. With a few recession years as exceptions, that has been the case ever since. The rise of the buyback fits all too nicely into the standard model's assumption that a harvested capital gain was identical to a dividend payment. Since payout ratios were irrelevant, according to the academics, and taxes on dividends were, or shall we say, had been higher, the buyback seemed like a good idea, and most importantly, one that fit in with the existing prejudice in regard to dividends. The second issue was the emergence of the dividend-free tech stock. The rise of this juggernaut dovetailed well with academic finance's orientation to asset prices, their correlations, their patterns, and their factors. The shift from measuring business success mostly in terms of cash returns to measuring it mostly in terms of share price gains had been largely completed. As with the initial period of high taxes on dividends, so with the latter period of, quote, missing out, end quote, on the skyrocketing tech stocks and the supposed virtues of share buybacks, there were plenty of real-world reasons why academic finance would take a dim view of dividends over the 60 or a year or so period since the original M&M propositions. In a practical sense, however, they boiled down to one overall charge, that by focusing on dividends, business investors were leaving a lot of money on the table. They were underperforming, in a total return sense, unnecessarily by not playing according to the house rules, which favor those who focused on share prices, not share distributions. This was a real problem, and I do not want to make light of it. Indeed, it has become harder and harder to be a traditional business owner come dividend investor in the stock market. Many of the market's leading companies just don't pay dividends anymore or have such low yields that no DCF or DDM can be made to work for them. At the aggregate level, the market's payout ratio, as measured by the S&P 500 index, has dropped from the 60 to 70% range and a yield about 4% or so, plus or minus in the decades up to M&M, to a 1.2% yield and a 30% payout ratio at the height of the internet bubble, the turn of the century. Right before the great financial crisis, the cash payout stood at a paltry 1.8% and a 30% payout ratio. And reflecting the rise of the dividend-light FANGs Plus, the yield of the market is once again 1.6%, a very low number, with a payout of 40% or so. That's presently. Now, I have to admit that there has been a bit of recovery in some of the metrics as a number of the more mature tech companies began to pay dividends over the past two decades. But it is simply a fact that the U.S. market remains dividend challenged. The one real and correct criticism that can be made in this literature is that the dividend investor has a smaller number of options to choose from now as a percent of the market than they had in the past. That is real and serious. This podcast does not challenge the numerous real-world practical challenges encountered by dividend-focused investors over the past 60 years. Rather, it questions the article of faith that a harvested capital gain is no different than a dividend, and that the rules of business ownership are different just because a company happens to be publicly traded. Those assertions pass without challenge or detailed justification in the dominant academic literature, the literature that is the legacy of M&M, or the literature in the currently vibrant paradigm of behavioral finance. From a business ownership perspective, however, the relative and absolute obstacles highlighted by those shouting from the academic parapets might just as easily be considered reasonable agency costs, the price of being a small shareholder in a desirable publicly traded corporation. I'll return to that positive notion in the second half of the podcast, but it is certainly true that at various times and for various reasons, those agency costs have been high, either in absolute terms in regard to taxes or in relative terms due to the NASDAQ phenomenon. Despite those obstacles, in the business environment context asserted here, the article of faith is the opposite. It is that the success and value of an enterprise, whether publicly traded or privately held, is directly linked to its ability to generate excess cash flows distributable to company owners. What other possible purpose for investing in a for-profit enterprise could there be? And so, one might reasonably ask, where is the literature on business ownership in which a profit distribution would enjoy its natural place? That's a great question. I've been searching for it. It's there, but you have to look for it. That's the topic of the second part of this special two-part episode of Keep Calm and Carry On Investing. I hope you'll listen in. Thank you for joining me.